Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hello and welcome to a special edition of Daisy is Careering. My name is Daisy Buchanan. I'm the host of the Your Book podcast and the author of Careering, a comic novel about Imogen, the eternal intern who finally gets her dream job, and Harry, her boss, a woman who has put much of her life on hold for work only to discover that her job will never love her back. Can they win against the system that's stacked against them, or is a rebellion the only way out? In this podcast, I speak to people I admire about the themes and issues that come up in careering. Our complicated love affairs with careers, achievement and ambition. Can we ever find fulfillment in the work we love? Or should we step away completely from toxic girl boss culture and try to find dreams that are bigger than our jobs? In this episode, I speak to the international best-selling author of The Push, Ashley O'Drain, about how writing was and is her dream job and how easy it is for us all to make compromises that serve our anxiety until playing it safe becomes dangerous. What did you want to be when you were growing up?
Well, I wanted to be a writer. That is what I've always wanted to be. And I think a writer of novels in particular, that was a fantasy, like very much a fantasy that somebody could become a novelist. And that for as long as I can remember, that is what I'd always wanted to be. Although, of course, I did not pursue that until much later in life.
Do you know where that came from when you first got this sense that, oh, there are stories that I love and someone is out there crafting them?
Yeah, I think especially around the time I was probably preteen, and reading the Babysitter's Club books, which were such a big part of sort of shaping how I understood that fiction that had real appeal to my life and who I could be. And these girls were not much older than I was. And this real reflection of, telling the story of, of these young girls who were my age and doing these cool things. And that idea of how prolific that was, they would come, there was always a new one coming out, and the idea of falling in love with this series and going to the store and the bookstore with my mom and trying to find one I hadn't read yet or waiting for them to come out. And that felt so magical,
It's so funny. I just wrote a book for a very small British indie publisher called The Pound Project, and the book's called Burn Before Reading.
Well, Daisy, I have it here. I have it right here. I ordered it.
Oh, my goodness. Oh, Ashley, that's so sweet of you. That's amazing. So as you know, possibly, it was the Babysitter's Club books that they were the first books I chose. And I was really lucky because my family, everyone was a big reader and there were lots of books around, but a lot of the books that were kind of given to me and sent my way were written a long time ago. And they were quite often about children going through real deprivation, and they were important lessons to learn. But the Babysitter's Club was the first book, the first time I was like, oh, you can just have this universe where everything is like okay and quite cozy. And obviously there's peril, obviously, like Marianne and Logan have their fights, but their sort of their personalities and their spirit, and that it was, I wanted to live in
exactly.
Stony Brook.
Oh, that's so funny, Daisy. It's so funny. This, your copy of Burn Before Reading, which is so, I know this is podcast, so people can't see I'm holding it up, but it's this lovely little book and it just arrived in the mail yesterday. So our timing was really impeccable, but I haven't had a chance to read it yet, but that's funny that you've mentioned that.
I'm delighted about that Babysitter's Club link. And also that your ambition was author, not childcare.
Yes, very much so. Very much so. And in fact, I really loathed babysitting as a teenager. I never wanted to do it. I did not enjoy it. But it was more just being pulled into this world that was created and the characters and the friendships and the time in light, like the age of the girls. And yeah, that really made me feel, I remember feeling like, I want to do this. I want to create this too. And then also, you know, writing a lot at that time, like really always wanting to write stories and loving English class and loving, writing everything from fiction to essays or short stories or whatever it was that was sort of on the curriculum at that time in school. So it's interesting. I was thinking about this the other day. I really think that it felt so unattainable at the same time, you know, even though I could hold these books in my hand and was so in love with them and, you know, was read ferociously. I didn't know a writer, you know, I didn't know an author. I certainly, you know, didn't know a novelist. It felt so far away and this unattainable thing. And I don't know that, I think it just took me a long time to feel like, oh, well, I could do that, you know, much, much older in my adult life.
And so I understand that before you wrote The Push, you were working in publishing. And how did that career begin? When did you become aware that this was kind of an industry? And did you start sort of, was that where you began your working life, or did you move from doing something else? What was your route in?
No, I really did not. I did not begin there. I began in public relations, working at a PR firm, PR agencies. I worked at a few different ones, probably for the first 10 years of my working life. I've obviously read Careering, your book, which was so, just so good. And it made me, although that is set in the world of magazines, it made me very nostalgic for the days of PR agency life, because it is very similar, actually, that the dynamic, the buzz, the relationship between coworkers and, I was working in media relations and for consumer brands and some fashion brands and technology and entertainment. And so I started there with, you know, in that world as an intern and then a very, very, very junior account executive and sort of, you know, would work my way up.
Sorry to interrupt, but was there an element, thank you so much for enjoying Careering. Yeah, I'm so happy that you did. When I remember, I don't know if this lands or not, I very, very briefly worked in PR and I was awful at it, but I remember thinking, oh, that's quite glamorous, that's quite fabulous, because that's what Gwyneth Paltrow does in Sliding Doors, even though she has an awful time in that movie. But I remember thinking, oh, that's quite a fun, if you can't write the magazines, this is a way to be around the magazines. And were you drawn to it because of those sort of the feelings of the glamour of the industry?
Absolutely, yes. I remember thinking, I mean, I had gone to university studied a media program in my undergrad. I actually remember thinking, as you know, a student in university, I would have loved to be on the media side. You know, I would have loved to be writing or, you know, doing something far more, I think, creative or like producing content. But I remember thinking at that time, well, I can't do that because I'll never make money. Like, I will never be able to have a steady paycheck. And I had this idea, I think because of the way I grew up and sort of watching my parents and their jobs and, you know, money always being an issue and them not loving their jobs or their careers at all. I remember thinking, well, I need to do something where, you know, I can make money and I need to be in business. I need to be, you know, you sort of get that feeling. I think especially at that time, like I graduated university in 2005, there was all of that, you know, narrative around being a woman in business and being, you know, all of this girl power and having it all. And this, you know, that was the narrative then. And I sort of felt like I needed to have a job that gave me a bit of cachet or power, and that felt like an office job, you know, an office job where you could slowly climb the ranks.
Really see the visual. We were all like, you know, in this sort of very like jewel tone skirt suits and looking very done, very polished, perfect blow dries. What did your parents do? Are they still, you know, working at the moment?
They're on their way to retirement now. But, you know, growing up, my mother always worked in retail. And I remember she worked so hard. Like, she really worked so hard. And she would work so many hours, and she had to work the holidays and evenings and weekends. And I remember, I just, she didn't, she loved the idea of, she, the mother loved clothing and she loved fashion and she loved to be around that kind of thing, but she didn't love working the retail hours. I mean, she had three young girls, she had three young kids, and she was working that job, like at various retailers. And I just remember thinking, God, that's so hard. It was so hard, you know, and it wasn't very fulfilling or satisfying. And my father worked mostly as a mortgage broker, you know, for most of my childhood, but was always self-employed. And that self, I remember just thinking, I remember just being very aware of, wow, like he, you know, he has control of his schedule and his office, and he has this sense of, you know, freedom, like he doesn't have to work for anybody. And that was always this, you know, thing that he didn't want to work for anybody. He wanted to work for himself. But along with that came a lot of financial stress and a lot of financial pressure. And he always, I felt like he was always very sort of affected by that, you know, and I think what I took away from that is, well, I don't want to be worried about money in that way. You know, I wanted that sort of more steady paycheck that felt sort of elusive to us, or to him at that time. Yeah.
And I think it's so fascinating what we absorb when we're children and the values we have about work and, you know, how it defines us or not and the choices we make. And I think that, you know, people forget, people are always kind of, I don't know if this resonates with you, but sometimes I feel like when I was a child, people were always sort of trying to manage my expectations and like, you know, don't like dream big, but not too big, like be realistic. And I think children actually, you know, probably aren't thinking after a certain point, you're like, oh, well, you know, I'll be a fireman, I'll be in the circus, that we're so aware and anxious and nervous. And we look at the people that we, you know, idolize and love and trust, who seem to have all the answers, and think, oh my goodness, if you're struggling, then I need to start thinking about how I'm going to avoid this pain and stress. And we never sort of think, oh, well, no matter what you do, the pain and stress is inevitable. You always think, you know, what's my escape route? How can I avoid this?
Yeah, yes, that really resonates with me. And I think I, financially, I really felt that way. I really felt like I, you know, my parents did fine and we, you know, never went without and, you know, like, but that it was, but they worked so hard and it was always a topic, always an issue. And I feel like I remember thinking, well, I just remember thinking I need to be financially independent. Like that was my takeaway from that, was that I did not want to worry in the way that they worried about money. But the message, really, the message that I got from them very loud and clear, I think, through, you know, all my childhood and certainly kind of in, you know, high school and university, was get an education, be more, do more. Like there was really, my parents really, they never really said to me or never put the pressure on to say, you know, you need to have a job that pays the bills or whatever. And I put myself through university. I mean, I had to work all through university and, you know, there wasn't, you know, it wasn't this free ride at all. But I do feel like they really did have this, you can do anything message. And so I think I felt, I was lucky, I think, in a sense that I felt both. I did feel like I could go and be the very first person to go to university in the family. Like that was an exciting thing. But I knew that I wasn't in a position to, you know, just try to be a writer, for example, or, you know, yeah, I did feel that pressure for sure. And I think that really shaped why I went into public relations, because I felt like it offered me both. It offered me this exciting world, and I wanted to work for other women. And, you know, it was a very female dominated space. And I loved the idea, just like in your book about, you know, going to the office and the outfits and all of that. I loved that at that time, you know, being a young graduate. But I was very hungry for money and hungry for promotion and hungry to feel just to have that financial independence.
I think that's such an exciting and specific feeling that I think really characterizes, you know, our 20s, especially. It sounds like, you know, sort of you're, you know, talented and ambitious and academic. And I think that when you do really well at school, you have a lot of that sort of energy where you want so much to do so well, but you're so used to kind of being told how to do well, And then you get to your job and nobody wants to give you a grade. Nobody wants to give you some sort of merit badge. So you've got to kind of figure out those feelings. And it's like, I'm so ambitious and I want this so much and I'll do anything, but also please tell me what to do because I don't know this. This is so new.
Totally. Yeah, I do remember that. And I remember being so, I am a person and I very much was so then, that needed those gold stars and needed the praise and needed the feedback. And so I actually think that sort of junior working life suited me well because, you know, you people do that. That is really what you get. I mean, I remember women, you know, that were more senior than me really taking me under their wing and, you know, giving me lots of feedback and wanting to help me succeed And I really liked that new experience, you know, of being, of having that dynamic in an office and in a job and feeling like, yes, there was no grade, but there were, you know, you would work so hard for that one, you know, comment from somebody more senior than you to say, wow, good job, well done. Or those emails that they would send back, you know, saying after you'd worked all night on a presentation, you know, saying, this is so well done, or this is so great. I mean, I really lived for that. I feel like that was so important to me back then, you know, as a very type A, high achieving young woman in that environment.
And I think it means so much when someone who is senior and experienced and seems very cool is willing to take the time to mentor you and help.
I do. Yeah, I loved that about that kind of working world. I loved that about those early career days. As a young woman who didn't, like, I mentioned, like, sort of that childhood, I didn't have any like examples or women that I looked up to that were like career women. You know, I didn't know any, like they were not the mothers of my friends and they were not, you know, anyone in my family. Like the women that I knew at that age were really, you know, like working jobs, but they weren't in that world or at that echelon of really being these like successful career women who were mentoring and who were, you know, you really looked up to in that world, because, you know, I didn't live in the city and we just weren't exposed to that. And so that really was very like captivating, I think, for me to like to interact with these women and feel like I was learning something from them. And I really, I guess, because I was in that world, I really only ever worked for women. And I loved that. I loved that about it. I loved that I felt very like mentored. And I that really meant a lot to me and shaped, I think, a lot of me.
That's really powerful. And I think probably really unusual. I imagine there aren't many of us who can say that. But I mean, that's what I loved about working for magazines. Mm. And I think of the team at Bliss, the teen mag where I started. And yeah, it was, you know, all girls, all amazing, you know, women. And I think that was kind of the first time. So I started when I was 23. Mm. And these women who were like in their mid-30s, who are slightly younger than I am now, yeah, and looking at them be like, wow, you've got it all figured out.
Yeah.
Your life is amazing. And then there was this, the publisher, it was this very sweet, very kind of tired man. I mean, one problem we have, I remember like really fighting for a story. This is quite serious about FGM, and it came from Save the Children, possibly. And it was one of those really, really sensitive things. And I wanted to include it. And there was the whole like, oh, you know, the advertisers are freaked out and, you know, for good reasons, really, really nervous about sort of her safety and her identity and anonymity. But I remember that, you know, feeling very sort of, obviously it's the wrong, it wasn't Ally McBeal because it wasn't the law, but that's, I must fight for this thing I believe in so much, I'm being a real journalist.
It's true, because you do find those moments for the first time, right? I think around that age, like you, and in that, I totally remember those same kind of experiences of feeling like you have this idea and you want to, and you feel so passionate about it and you want to convince everyone that it's the right idea and the right, you know, you sort of, for the first time, I think you sort of find this, you sort of toy with this conviction in yourself, you know, that, and it's, and it, and you are, and you were for the first time meant to convince others around you and play this role on a team. And it is very powerful.
And it does feel like the stuff that movies are made of, and you do I convinced myself. No, this ends on everyone standing on their desks and applauding me. Oh. Like the narcissist I am. So how did you move from PR into publishing?
So
was the books, was that sort of a burning passion that was just kind of get roaring more loudly.
Yes, for sure. I think the thing about working in public relations agencies, you know, on the when your clients are in that sort of consumer space, you know, I as much as I loved it and loved the teams and the people and the buzz of it all and the energy of it all, you know, at the end of the day, you are working so hard to help your client promote, you know, a chocolate bar or a laundry detergent or some fashion item, you know, and it felt, I think after a while, it started to feel to me like the meaning was getting sort of, I couldn't find the meaning that I really wanted in it. And I had met, well, this is a whole nother topic, I think, about the friendships we form at work, which are so unique and some of my best friendships today, for sure. But I'd met a woman named Beth, and we had both been very junior account executives at one of the PR agencies I worked for. And we really clicked right away and we loved working together. And then she moved on to other jobs and so did I, but we always stayed in touch and had lunch all the time and were quite close. And she eventually worked her way over to working in publishing. And she was at Penguin Random House Canada. And she was, had become, you know, their most senior sort of publicity marketing person there. And one day she called me and she knew at the time I was, you know, becoming a little disenchanted with that PR agency world. And I was doing all sorts of writing classes and writing all the time. And like I would take all these night courses, you know, doing fiction writing. And she knew how much I loved all of that. And a job came up on her team to work in publicity there. And so she called me and said, I really think you should apply for this job. And I had always just loved hearing her talk about her job and being in this world of publishing, which felt like this dream world, you know, to me. And so I was very lucky to like apply for that job and get that job and headed up the publicity team there. And she was my boss. She was the person I reported to. And so that to me felt like this, like such an exciting turn, you know, because I could do the thing that I could use all the skills that I had, but it was in this world of books finally. And it felt, I remember it feeling just so exciting, but so daunting. And it's almost that thing, it was almost that feeling like, you know, when you sometimes get scared to meet your hero because you're afraid they'll disappoint you. And it was that sort of same feeling, like, I hope I love it as much as I think I will. But I did, I really loved it. And I worked there for a few years in publishing. Yeah. And it was that feeling of like a kid in a candy store, you know, going to work every day and totally intimidating. So, so intimidating, but just to be surrounded by all of those books and, you know, the authors and just to be, I remember just feeling so lucky, like sitting in on the conference room, you know, listening to these conversations and feeling like I just couldn't believe I was that privy to all of this information.
I love that. And was it ever weird that your old friend and comrade was now your boss, that, you know, you had this friendship, that this is the person you're reporting to?
You know, it really wasn't. And I think part of it was because I was so, it wasn't my world. Like she was bringing me into this world where she'd worked for several years by that point. And she's just one of these women who she has no ego and she is so, and, you know, just so warm and supportive. And it really wasn't an issue. And also she actually went on maternity leave really soon after I joined. And then I filled in for her role while she was on maternity leave. So we actually didn't get that much. We had it, you know, just over a year where we weren't even working together, but it really wasn't an issue at all. And I was really grateful for that. But yeah, and she's still a dear friend to this day. And actually she, now that I am published by Penguin, I still work with her in some capacity because she's my publisher.
That is really awesome. Because I do think, you know, what you were saying, that those friendships, when you are in that, especially I think maybe before you turn sort of 30-ish and those early years are just so full of so highs and lows, and they really, really bond you. And it is over, I think, the sort of the all-nighters in the office and, you know, the complaining
for sure, the complaining, the walk that we would walk, you know, there was, at that time when I worked at Penguin, there was three of us who were quite close, another woman who was around our age who was kind of on our team, and the three of us just felt so bond. You bond over the things that annoy you, you bond over the wins, you bond over the failures. Like I remember you know, walking, we would walk every day for lunch, you know, to get salads together and chat the whole way and then chat the whole way back. And that was just this point in the day where you know, really look forward to. And we would, just, you know, the going for drinks after work and all of that. It was just such a part of life at that point in your 20s, you know, it was such a, I became as close to those work friends as I did to any other friends in my life.
Someone asked me a really good question the other day, and I was like, I don't know what to tell you, especially now. And I don't know if you have this where, you know, the work we do, so a lot of it is kind of, you know, if we're lucky, we might have a lovely Zoom, but lots of it is quite, you know, you're quiet and you're in a room on your own, but working in an office, and how do we kind of convert those work friendships to like real life friendships? Because I think that to a point it's super organic, and if you're really lucky it helps if you've got kind of events to go to, like at the magazine there are always launches, and I imagine that you had book launches and things to go to, but it really is quite scary to be the first one who's like, oh, do you want to do something on Saturday?
Yes, like, outside of work, yes.
And they might like look askance, and you're like, forget I said anything.
Yeah, no, for sure. I do remember feeling that way. And similarly, once you leave a job, you know, how you continue those. And, you know, like this third friend that we sort of had, this triangle of us when I was working in publishing, you know, I left to go to have my baby, and we really didn't talk much after that. We really sort of, life was just busy for me and busy for her. And there wasn't that, but then there would be instances or moments where I felt like something came up that was relevant, you know, to our friendship, or something I knew she would love. And we would message each other or send an email, or, and it really is like no time has passed, you know, even though you don't see them every day. Or recently I've seen her in person, and it's just, it was just this, it's like the same thing, the same conversation, it all kind of comes back. So yeah, it's funny. But I think also what's interesting about that is I find they are very low pressure friendships, you know, if on the scale of friendships. I think that there is something about those working friendships that you get so close just by sheer number of hours spent together, you know, and all of those things we're talking about. But I think what's unique about them is that I certainly never felt that same pressure to keep up or invite them to something special, or, you know, I feel like there is this license to kind of let go when you have to. And I think that that's special about them or unique about them.
Definitely. Especially now, I think, where, you know, maybe years ago people changed jobs a lot less, people sort of stayed in the wrong place, like you had your friends and they were your friends, and now we just can't. I know the social media, the internet is designed for this, but we just cannot possibly be as close to all the people all the time. There's just not enough space in our heads. So yeah, I think that, you know, to love someone and let them go and maybe they'll come back, I think it's nice to take the pressure off. I'm really curious about how it felt to be a person who loved writing and was working on this craft and that you were doing it, you know, kind of in your own time. But then being in publishing, being around authors, learning about what's possible. And I sometimes think that it can, knowing much more about the industry and that world, can be a real blessing and a curse. I've got a friend who works in TV.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
And has done more or less since she graduated, and said that she got incredibly lucky because she just happened to talk to people, email people, be very, you know, bright and ambitious and enthusiastic. But also she said, if I'd had one realistic conversation with anyone who told me how hard it was to get into this field, I wouldn't have tried. Yeah. I would have known too much. Like my ignorance, you know, mm-hmm. brought me bliss.
Mm-hmm. No, I can relate to that. I mean, I think it's interesting. As I mentioned before, when I was working in the PR agency world, I was always writing. I was taking all these courses and trying to like work on that craft and all, and I loved that. When I started working in publishing, I really stopped doing all of that writing. At the time, I think I probably had the excuse of things were so busy and I had to read so much and, you know, adjusting to that new world or that new job. But I think really the reason I did not write at all for those few years is just that intimidation factor, you know, that really, I mean, it's intimidating enough to, you know, to believe you could, you know, to think you could be a writer or write a novel. But then when you're in that world, you know, it just felt like, well, they are the writers and I am the person who promotes the books. You know, that is, I am on this side and they are on that side. And there felt like I didn't feel like I could be one of them or had the right to be one of them. I mean, I think there's this pedigree, you know, that a lot of writers have, or that we think a lot of writers, we assign to a lot of writers. And I just didn't feel like I had that, you know? And I think that even, and I mean, it's funny because even though I was spending so much time with them, like I was a publicist and I was taking them on tour and doing events with them and having all these lunches. And, you know, so in one way, I mean, I do know publicists who feel very like would say that, well, spending all that time with writers, you realize that it's not intimidating and they are just people and, you know, and that is absolutely the truth. But I didn't necessarily feel that way. I did feel a lot of intimidation there. And so, yeah, but I do think it was a time of great learning. And I can see that now too, that it was probably the best education in writing that I had, even though I was not writing, you know, learning how they worked and learning how they thought about their work. And reading far more widely than I'd ever read before, and that in itself was a real education as a writer. So there was that side of it, I think. But there, you know, there was also the side that I think now that, you know, I am a published author, I see it prepared me to see publishing with a very realistic lens. I understand that publishing first and foremost is a business. Because I've been on that business side. And so that does not surprise me now as a writer. And I can approach it that way. I can see it through that lens, which I don't know that all writers can. I think it can be harder sometimes to understand it that way, but it is, it's a business. And I know how decisions are made on the inside. And I know how the sausage is made, you know? And so it does change. It does change how it feels to be on this side a little, I think.
I think you're absolutely right in terms of, you know, the wide reading. And, you know, if anyone were to ever ask me for any writing advice, that's all I tell them. That anything I know about writing, I have learned from reading, for sure. And also reading whatever I can get my hands on, you know, be that the Brontes or Jane Austen or the Babysitter's Club. But yeah, I think I've still struggled with that, like the rational, practical, you know, not being, I don't know, sentimental isn't quite the right word. Mm. But, you know, when we do write, and I think that, you know, what makes your writing so, you know, beautiful and brilliant and meaningful, and people respond to it so much because it's, you know, there's something really real. I feel as though you are telling the tale you want to tell, you know, what you're connected to and what you're driven to tell. Mm. And I do sometimes think that, as has happened with The Push, those are the stories that really, really land, that people really, you know, love and grab. And I think that lots of people perhaps do approach, you know, publishing and writing in a way where they think, oh, I want to do something that I know is going to be popular.
Yes.
And I think sometimes that works out, but also, I don't know, I think we have to love our work because then we'll always have one fan.
We do. That's right. No, we do. We really do. And I agree with that. And I think The Push did feel that way. It felt like this story that I had to write that was burning in me. I really felt this obsession with that story and needing to write it. And I think that that is this magical thing as a writer, you know, when you can find that or when you can feel that way. So I'm glad that comes across. So thank you for that. But, you know, it's interesting because at the time that I started writing that book, which was 2015, It was around the time that, and actually I had read this book on submission right before I went on maternity leave, but Girl on the Train, it was that time where, you know, Girl on the Train was just coming out and was, you know, this huge success. And there had already, Gone Girl was already out. Like that whole world of, you know, call it domestic suspense or that kind of thriller, was really just taking off, and having worked on the publishing side, that was what they were always looking for. You know, the editorial side was always looking for what that next book was going to be. And then when it came time to write, I mean, because people will say, oh, were you kind of influenced by that, by what was selling at the time? And I think it's hard not to be. It's hard not to, like, it's hard not to have that awareness and be in that world. And then, you know, you and know that that is what people are enjoying.
I was going to say, I think those stories do set something off in our brains, mm-hmm. where there can be like a genre or a feeling. And I think that can be as much of an imaginative trigger as everything. Like the novel that I have just handed in is now completely, completely, completely different from how I originally conceived it. But I first started thinking about what it might be immediately after I watched Promising Young Woman.
Oh, yeah. Mm.
And I know lots of people who saw that movie and went, oh my God, we all sort of went off in different directions with it. But yeah, I think to read what's popular and what's kind of as a reader rather than as a kind of as a trend forecaster.
Yeah, no, totally. And I think it informs a mood while you're writing. There's an influence in voice, I think, for sure. And just, and of course you have to, you know, find your own voice and find your own story and all of that. But that is what is in the atmosphere at the time that you are writing. And so it does, I think, have an influence. Not that you can ever hope to replicate or copy or any of that, because we know that that is not a game you will ever win. You know, it is, you have to be original and the also the practical matter of, you know, the pace at which books are published. You know, what is hot today is, you know, not necessarily going to be hot 2 years from now when a book comes out that you might be working on now, you know? And so, yeah, you really have to just go with your instinct kind of on it, which is, I think what happened with The Push, I was not setting out to write a thriller. That's what, you know, was hot and I was reading at the time. So that was in me, but I didn't know how to write a thriller. I didn't think about structure of thriller. I didn't study them. It wasn't like that. It kind of just ended up in this very suspenseful territory. When what I wanted it to be really was this study of this family, you know, and that was the core of what it started like.
Do you recommend writing courses for new writers? I must admit, I don't think I've ever been on a writing course, which seems like a sort of a remiss thing to, like, the arrogance of me. Be like, no, I just thought I'd do it.
No, you know, I really recommend it. I mean, it's funny because I mean, I think maybe because I didn't study English, I didn't study writing in school, like in university, I didn't have an MFA, like all of that was not part of my world or my experience at all. And so I really felt like I just felt like I knew nothing about how to go about it all. Beyond the fact that I just love to just start writing a scene and start writing a chapter and love the actual, you know, joy or act of writing. The reason I took the course was because I think two reasons. One, I wanted to feel some sense of, you know, I feel like I have this in me. This feels so intuitive to me, but I almost wanted this gut check, you know, like, am I on the right track? Is this good? And so there was that, but there was also the critique part of it, you know, and I think that's what I took away the most from all of these writing courses I did, which were just, you know, night courses at the community college down the street. But it was a chance, or the very first chance, I think, that I had to show my fiction to anybody and have them read it and give feedback and critique. That was terrifying, but also thrilling, you know, that feeling where you just, I absolutely loved it and completely feared it. Yeah, it was that standard, you know, format where you write something a week, you exchange it with everyone in the group, you all come to the table and you give each other feedback. And it was one thing I loved about these, you know, very community writing courses was it was such a cast of characters in the class as well. And I, you know, you could write a whole novel about the people around the table, you know, in some of these classes, and all different backgrounds and all different experiences and all different ages. And it was so, I've just found it so fun and so, I learned so much in that. I mean, you certainly do learn just as much critiquing other people's work as you do receiving critique. And so it was sort of this rough and tumble MFA style experience. And yeah, I just loved it. And I still stay in touch with a lot of those writers. It was many years ago now, but every once in a while I'll get an email from one. And yeah, it's really, I don't know, it was really special. It was a special way to begin that writing journey in earnest, because you have to declare to people that you are writing and that you are, you know, and I don't think I ever told, I really, not many people knew I was even doing these writing classes all the time, but it was just this, yeah, it was just this really meaningful start, I think, to the whole thing. And I'm really grateful for that. Yeah. And it was also one of those, actually, there was, oh, it's so interesting. You'll appreciate this. But there was one woman who, this was pre 50 Shades, and she was in her 60s, maybe in her mid 60s. She was wonderful, this woman, Sylvia. I really loved her. And she was writing erotic fiction in that class. I remember everyone being so like, what, you're writing erotic fiction? Like, and it was, you know, all of these people just blushing around the table, you know, reading this stuff. And I loved her work. And I thought it was so bold and interesting. And she really believed that this could be something. And I think most people doubted her. And then lo and behold, you know, we had that, the 50 Shades and everything that came after. And I always think of her to say she was a real visionary in that class. Yeah.
That's amazing. I love that. And I love the confidence of yes. sharing that work.
Yes.
And it was so interesting because when you were talking about that and kind of like the feedback, and I was thinking, and I'm sure now, you know, you've had that experience of kind of like people will just say anything on like Goodreads or Instagram, yeah. whatever. And sometimes it's really lovely and sometimes it ruins your weekend.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm sure not. I'm sure they only say brilliant things about the book because it's brilliant.
But
the idea of like being sat around a table, hearing mm-hmm. people telling me what they think, I'm like, oh God, that sounds awful. That sounds horrible. And I'm like, you know what? Actually, maybe it's a really, really brilliant skin thickener. Yes. Maybe I could do with a little bit more of that now.
Yeah, it really is. It is. It actually prepared me very well for being edited later, you know, as in this position that I am in now, where I've, you know, got editors and lots of feedback, lots of very official, you know, feedback. It does. It totally thickened my skin, that experience.
I'd love to know about future novels for you and what it's like to, because, you know, what happened with your debut novel does not happen to, I would say, 99.99999% of writers, where it's sort of this, you know, international bestseller, sort of hugely exciting for everyone. When, after that has happened, how do you sit down and kind of create a new world and step away from all of that and liberate yourself from the pressure to do it again?
Oh, thanks. Well, it was interesting because I think, so when The Push sold, it was a 2-book deal, and I sold the second book on an idea. I had a 1-pager of this idea that, you know, truthfully was not very thoroughly thought out, but it was this, you know, a concept of what I really wanted the second novel to be. So I have this commitment, you know, to this idea. And because there was a really long period of time, there was 18 months between signing that book deal and then The Push coming out, which was quite a long time, even for the world of publishing. And so I was able to get a first draft done of the second book in that time period, which was enormously helpful. I mean, it was a totally shitty first draft, as they all are, but maybe particularly bad, I will say. But it was there. It was something to work with, and it was a start. And that really helped because it was just this anchor to keep going back to, you know, after when I had to turn my attention, you know, to writing, to keep writing that, to revising it after The Push came out. But I think, you know, what was more challenging than anything was just the circumstance of the pandemic. I found that so hard as a writer. And I know we all, and I mean, I will preface this by saying one of the most privileged positions you could have been in, you know, in the world during the pandemic is a writer who can stay home and write every day. There is that for sure. But I guess within that world, you know, with this deadline looming and 2 kids at home with schools closed, and we had quite strict, there was quite strict rules here. I'm in Toronto in Canada, and like it was ruled you couldn't leave your house. It was felt very trapped. And that's a very challenging environment in which to be creative. as you will know, or as most people appreciate. And so that I found that hard. I found that tricky because I felt very stifled in terms of just, you know, room to think and room to work. And that was the time period where I was meant to be revising the book and working on it quite heavily. So there was some pushed deadlines for sure. But eventually got through it and really had, I mean, the only solution was really to get up at 5 a.m. and write for a few hours every day and then do the homeschooling and, you know, do all of that. And then maybe get another hour, you know, in the evening after they went to bed. But I found that really grueling, really hard. So that kind of, I would say that I think, you know, there might maybe writers in their second book situation like that, who find themselves unable to, like with writer's block, or unable to kind of tap into that creativity or the same voice. And I feel like mine was always there kind of burning. There was just no time to address it, no time to let it out. So time was really the enemy at that point more than anything.
And my goodness, getting up at 5 and just, you know, working about 24 hours a day, it sounds like. I mean, something that I'd like to talk about more in this podcast, I don't have children. I have a lot of friends who do. I think that it's easy to assume that a very successful writer working from home, you're like, oh, you could just do it all. You can just fit it all in. It's all fine. And I don't think it is fine. I think certainly in the UK, and I want to believe that Canada is like way more progressive and on it than we are, because, you know, Canada is wonderful. And because everyone is, frankly, more progressive and on it in the UK. But I think there are just massive, massive gaps in terms of how we support, we're going to say mothers especially, and this sort of having it all. And I guess it kind of, it maybe helps a little bit when children are at least at school and out of the house, when there's not a pandemic going on. And I guess that, you know, we know those gaps are there and no one wants to talk about them. And I think the pandemic really exposed them.
Oh, for sure. No, yeah, I would love to talk about just that whole idea of, well, you know, motherhood and work. But I think, yes, also motherhood and creative work. You know, it's interesting because when, I guess just to back up a little, when I left publishing, I left because I was going to go on maternity leave. And that was in Canada, we have 12 months of maternity leave. And so that my plan was sort of to be off for the year, you know, and do that and then definitely go back to work. And when my son was born, he had very significant health challenges that we didn't know about, or we didn't know about when I was pregnant. And quickly, like, that became this completely consuming thing. You know, as we all know, having a baby is consuming enough, but I think having a baby with, you know, health challenges where they are, you know, admitted to hospital for long periods of time and all that, it really, you know, completely turns your world upside down. And I decided, maybe, like, I guess around the time I started writing, like around 6 months in, like when he was around 6 months old, I just realized, like, I couldn't go back to work, you know, with that, with the needs that my child had and, you know, like just the care that he needed at that time and all of the hospital time and all of that. So I kind of made that decision halfway through the maternity leave not to go back. But was very lucky to be in a position to do that. And that was a complete privilege, you know, that I feel like a lot of my writing life has been a result of that privilege. But yeah, I really, that time, I think I really realized, like, I could see, you know, everywhere in the halls of the hospital and, you know, all of that, the mothers who couldn't make that choice and had to, you know, leave their baby at a hospital for a day and go to work and come back at night and pumping all day and trying to breastfeed. I mean, it was just, it is so hard. It is so hard. So many people are in such tough situations, you know, when it comes to that balance, but in a weird way, you know, that did allow me to start writing. And I don't think I would have started writing if I had gone back to that job in publishing. I'm almost certain that I would not have started writing. So in a way, it kind of worked out in this sort of strange way for me. But yeah, I think you asked more specifically about kind of that creativity and writing and, oh, you're a writer all day and so you're home. I mean, childcare is something that writers don't talk about a lot. And I've done some events with writers recently where women, mothers, who we've all talked about childcare. And, you know, if you cannot afford to pay a babysitter to watch your kids while you write, it is very, very difficult to be productive. And there are not many people who are, you know, aspiring to write or even published writers who can afford to pay for childcare while they write. And so, it is tough. And I think for a lot of families and a lot of women, because the creative work or the work of writing, it can be hard to justify to ourselves or to others sometimes, you know, because it is not this 1 hour of work equals a certain billing rate or a certain whatever. It is structured just so differently. It can just be really hard, I think, to justify, which it shouldn't be, but it does feel that way sometimes.
Yeah, I think there's no solution. And I think, you know, that's so true as well, that the nature of writing, I mean, it's something I really, really struggle with, the sort of how much of the work is work. Mm. Like, I'm working all the time, but am I working? Mm-hmm. And something I really, really miss about freelance journalism, there was a period where I was doing a lot more kind of tight turn around like opinion pieces. And it was like, here's your rate. And it's like, well, I can do this in 2 hours. I've made this much money a day. This feels like an acceptable day rate. I am like a human being productive. And it's so much more kind of nebulous with books and the sort of, you know, emails about like, oh, I'm, you know, just arranged to go for a cup of coffee with my new publicist and that's work. But is it work? Again, I think because my parents put a lot of pressure on me to do well at school, which was, you know, I think the best of intentions. And that's sort of how can I justify what I do all day, and trying to remind myself, like, no one cares. No one is interested. No one is checking.
Yes, it's true.
I'm still trying to impress a teacher who does not exist.
Okay. Me too. No, I get that. I really get that. Yeah. Yeah. I think a lot of it comes with, I mean, I hope a lot of it comes with, feels better over time, you know, with wisdom and, you know, with age. And it's interesting. I can feel myself starting to let go of that a little bit. And maybe that's just post-pandemic. Maybe that's just my kids being a bit older. I don't know. But starting to let go of that a little bit. But it's still there. It's still there, that need to want to feel proving and productive. And even like the in writing, there's so much time spent thinking, you know, and that those days when, you know, you feel, oh, you feel so excited because you've got, you know, 4 hours ahead where it's just you and your laptop and you're going to go to your favorite writing place or the library or wherever you want to write and you're just going to do it, you know. And then sometimes those days you produce hardly anything, you know, you really do. You leave feeling sort of disappointed in yourself and you haven't hit a word count and you haven't, but that, you know, I can see looking back on projects. I mean, it's still productive time in a weird sense, because you have, you know, you've thought through things in a certain way, or you decide what you don't want to write about, or you, you know, even if you delete something, or, you know, but that it's very hard to come to terms with that in this society, I think, about that being productive.
I still remember so vividly the moment when I figured out the ending for Insatiable, my first novel, and I'd written 50,000 words and I was stuck. And I was like, do I thriller it up? Do I go dark? I don't know what, I've got all these people and I've got their story, but I don't know where it goes. And it came to me, and I just, I'd been to the gym and I'd been to the supermarket and it was really rainy and really windy and I'd had these really heavy shopping bags and I was on foot and I was feeling really, really fed up and just trying to kind of, you know, when the rain is just like driving into your face and you're kind of trying to duck it, and all of that was going on. And then this bit of my brain lit up and I was like, oh, and I was thinking about this one character and I'm like, oh, she's just kind of, I don't know who she is, and she's just quite cruel and quite mean and she's annoying. And I was like, oh no, maybe she's the whole story. And I think it's almost like I had to just distract as much of my brain as possible. And all of that anxiety and that really forceful, panicky kind of, you know, trying to push myself. And then, and that was like, that was a really great working day in terms of what, you know, it was invaluable. I could have written like I could never have written 10,000 words in a day. My absolute maximum on a really good writing day, I think I could do 3,000 words.
Yeah, but that's, wow, which still.
That's
yeah,
a good day.
Good day. Oh, I can totally relate to that. And you wouldn't, you know, clock that up to being, you know, the traditional, it doesn't look like the good working day, you know, but it is. I had the same similar experience where I was a few weekends ago, I went to New York with my mother and my two sisters, which was so fun. And this long overdue, we'd never done a girls trip, all of us together. And I was feeling a little bit, you know, guilty before I went about, like, you know, just that feeling of, oh, I really got to be working on this next idea and, like, you know, trying to figure it out and I need to get things on paper and feeling a bit of that pressure, but went and had so much fun and was really enjoying the weekend. And then on the last day walking, you know, wherever we were walking through somewhere, Greenwich Village or somewhere with my sister and having this very kind of, you know, casual conversation with her. And all of a sudden this real pivotal moment in the next book just came to me in this conversation that we were having. And it was like, and it felt the same. It was the same thing. It was this, my subconscious really handing me this beautiful gift, you know, on this weekend that I'd completely taken off of work. So sometimes it does happen that way, you know, and it is all the work that you do before that, that sets you up for those beautiful moments, you know? So we do need to reconsider, you know, what that success looks like.
I am so delighted for you. What a gorgeous thing to happen. Ashley, I could just like talk to you for the rest of the day, the rest of the week, but I know you've probably got things to do. So I end this by asking, and I suspect I know what you're going to say. Mm. What does the expression dream job mean to you?
Mm. Well, yes, I am living it. I am living it. I really am. I feel, you know, it's funny because yes, to circle back to what we first talked about, you know, this was the thing I always dreamed of that I couldn't see my way to or didn't know how to get there, but always wanted. And so I am truly, truly grateful for it every day to be doing this.
I think that's my favorite answer. Aww. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
It's been so lovely to spend this time with you.
Thank you,
Daisy. So much for coming on the podcast.
Thank you
so
much.
I've had a blast. Huge thanks to Ashley. Daisy is Careering is produced by Dale Shaw for New Alaska, with special thanks to Sphere and Little Brown and Doubleday Canada. Careering is published in the UK by Sphere and in North America by Doubleday Canada. It's available online and from all good bookshops. I leave you with this from Maya Angelou. The desire to reach the stars is ambitious. The desire to reach hearts is wise. Thanks for listening.